Okay, let's go to Exodus chapter 25. We did 7 points of introduction to the tabernacle, and now we're ready to look into some of the details. And as the tabernacle is proposed, we'll just simply list out several things that are important. And the first important thing coming to Exodus 25 is to note that the whole idea was proposed by God, not man. So the whole idea of the tabernacle was God's. It was not initiated by Moses. It was not the idea, wouldn't it be nice if the Lord who leads us in the wilderness had a visible place to dwell? Let's make a place and invite him to come join us. That was not the idea at all. And the whole idea revolved about two things. First of all, the idea revolved about the financing. The financing was proposed by God. And second, we'll find out that the fellowship was proposed by God. First of all, the financing in 25, 1 through 6. Reading. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Tell the sons of Israel to raise a contribution." Notice God's idea, not theirs. "Tell the sons of Israel to raise a contribution for me. From every man whose heart moves him, you shall raise my contribution. This is the contribution which you are to raise from them: gold, silver, bronze, blue, purple, scarlet, fine linen, etc. Verse 6, oil for lighting, spices for the anointing oil, and for fragrant incense, onyx stones and setting stones for the ephod and for the breastplate. Now, the first thing we want to ask is, God proposes these people bring a contribution. The first question is, where did they get the gold and the silver and the bronze? Where did that come from? Where did they get these expensive items? Remember, they're out in the desert, and there isn't gold and silver and fine things like this lying around in the desert. Where did it come from? Anyone remember? Came from Egypt. Go back to chapter 12, and we'll get a lesson coming off of this. Chapter 12, verse 35 and 36. And as we went through this, the question that crossed my mind and I couldn't really answer at the time is, why did God have them do this? What are they going to do with this gold and silver? What are they going to do with this jewelry? Is this just to go and of course, my mind works like yours does. If they had the jewelry, they would use it for themselves, right? They would put it in their jewelry boxes because they were like us. And so you read in verse 35, "Now the sons of Israel had done according to the words of Moses, for they had requested from the Egyptians articles of silver, articles of gold, and clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians so that they might have their request. Thus they plundered the Egyptians." And you kind of look at it, well, God was just being nice to them. "We don't want you to go out of here without anything, and so I'll move the Egyptians so you ladies can have some nice things to go around your neck." No, that's not the point at all. The point at all is God gave to them so they could give back to God. So let's put down the principle. God gave to them so they could give back to him. God gave to them, not so they could use it on themselves, but so they could give it back. Now, there is a principle that we have developed in the New Testament about this, which is this principle. The idea is, when you give, God multiplies. God does not multiply material goods we keep. God multiplies material goods we give. Keeping your finger here, the principle is 2 Corinthians chapter 8, or chapter 9, rather. 2 Corinthians 9. The whole 8th and 9th chapter of 2 Corinthians is about giving material things. And in chapter 9, verse 10, he's talking about giving under the idea of giving is like planting seed. You see, when you plant the seed, God gives you more seed to plant. When you give, God gives you more to give. And so you have verse 10. "He who supplies seed to the sower and bread for the food will multiply and supply and multiply your seed for sowing." And sowing seed is the figure at this particular point for giving. And so the principle is God multiplies it as he gives it. Did that work? Go to Exodus once again, this time chapter 36, verses 5 and 6. the principle of sowing and having it multiplied worked so well that the workmen on the tabernacle had said, Moses, you're going to have to stop it. The people are just running us. They're giving too much. And so a command comes forth to stop the giving. Chapter 36, verse 5, they, referring to the workmen on the sanctuary, they said to Moses, the people are bringing much more than enough for the construction work which the Lord commanded us to perform. So Moses issued a command, and a proclamation was circulated throughout the camp saying, let neither man nor woman any longer perform work for the contributions of the sanctuary. Thus the people were restrained from bringing any more. And so notice how the principle works is that God says, I want you to give, and the principle of giving is illustrated by the way God multiplies what the people gave. We generally see the reverse today. Christian leaders buy something and then lay the trip on people to please. We're not making our payment this month. We need help. And that's just the reverse, the way you've got it here. Okay. The financing was proposed by God. Second, the fellowship was also proposed by God. And that is found in Exodus 25, verse 7, which reads, verse 8. Verse 8, it said, let them construct a sanctuary for me that I may dwell among them. In other words, I am proposing to have fellowship with these my people. God is the initiator all the way through. The other thing that is important here is, and it really relates back to the financing part, but it ties in with the fellowship, is there's a great emphasis, and we'll insert it here, a great emphasis on the idea that this must be willing. There can be no compulsion, no pressure at all. People must want to give or God didn't want it. Notice that emphasis. Chapter 25 and verse 2. Strong emphasis. Don't bring it if you don't want to. If it isn't from the heart, don't give. Verse 2. Tell the sons of Israel to raise a contribution from me, from every man. And what is the rest? Whose heart moves him. In other words, we want only willing gifts. Notice the re-emphasis two other places in chapter 35. Same book, chapter 35. Three places here is an emphasis on it's got to be willing. It's got to be grace is what it's saying. 35:5. Take for, and this is just repeating the same thing. By the way, there's a lot in the latter part of Exodus that will be almost verbatim repetition. We'll have several chapters that way. This is one of them. Verse 5, take from among you a contribution to the Lord. Whoever is of a willing heart, let him bring it to the Lord. Notice the emphasis on free, volition, on grace. Verse 21, everyone whose heart stirred him, and everyone whose spirit moved him came and brought the Lord's contribution for the work of the tent of meeting and for all its service and for all the holy garments. Then all whose hearts moved them, both men and women, came and brought these following contributions. And I didn't read the rest of the verse because I don't know how to pronounce B-R-O-O-C-H. What is a brooch? What's a brooch? A what? A brooch? What's a brooch? Okay. Okay, well, they brought them. Only bring your brooches if you're willing, is the emphasis. Okay, verse 29, same chapter, verse 29. The Israelites, all the men and women whose heart moved them to bring material for all the work which the Lord had commanded through Moses to be done, brought a free will offering to the Lord. So notice God is proposing that I want you to bring a contribution to me. I'm asking for it, but I do not want it if it is not of a willing heart. And the people brought it of a willing heart, so much so that there was a great abundance of it. So the first point to note then is the whole thing of the tabernacle is God's idea. One other thing we ought to add, notice the materials they are bringing is in order to construct the tabernacle, they say, bring all of your old, used clothes. and put them in the and we'll be able to kind of patch them together. If you have some old blankets that you're not using anymore, bring those and we'll hang them out to get the mothball smell out of them. And then we will sew them all together to put a lid over this tabernacle. No, principle here. God's house deserves the best. God's house deserves the best. They didn't bring junk. They brought their jewelry, their expensive things. And that principle goes all the way through. God's house deserves the very best. Nothing was second rate. All right, closing out then, you have two more things in these first few verses. A word, first of all, about God's presence being there, and that is in the eighth verse of chapter 25. Verse 8, and let them construct a sanctuary for me that I may dwell among them, divine presence. And then finally, an emphasis, as we made this morning, on the pattern. So you've got three things then. A proposal, God is the one that takes the initiative, His presence is to be there, and there is to be a pattern in the way this thing is put together and the way it is made. Now, tonight, we want to go, and we're going to move into this part, the Holy of Holies. Again, you probably know the parts of the tabernacle. This is the outer court, and then the tabernacle proper, the holy place here. Then you have this curtain, and then you have the Holy of Holies. And we're going to talk about three things tonight. We're going to talk about the furniture in here, which is the ark, and we'll say something about the box, and we'll say something about the lid on the box. Then the third thing that is associated with this Holy of Holies is this curtain, very expensive veil. So we'll talk about the box, the lid on the box, and then the veil. Okay, let's begin then with the ark itself, or the box, the ark. And the first thing we'll say about it is the ark has some unique features that make it distinct and different and stand out from the other parts of the tabernacle. The first unique feature of the ark is it's the only thing in the Holy of Holies. It is the only furniture in the Holy of Holies. Nothing else there. And I'm going to use HH, so I won't have to write that all evening. Nothing was in there in terms of furniture except that. That's not true of the holy place. Of the holy place, there was three pieces of furniture. Outside there in the courtyard, you had two. I guess you wouldn't call the laver and the brazen altar furniture, but there were two pieces out here. But only one in this particular place, and that will be significant, as we'll see later. Second, all of the ritual relates to the ark. All of the ritual, in some way, relates to the ark. Whatever is done elsewhere relates to that. For example, we're going to have the altar of incense, which is right on this side of the veil. And the way you know the altar of incense is in the right place is it is positioned relative to the ark. It was to go directly in front of it. So where it sits, its very position, was related to the ark. On the Day of Atonement, when blood is shed out here, the high priest brings the blood from the altar and it goes onto the lid of the ark. Everything relates in some way to the ark. The veil, significant part of it. The veil, expensive veil, that was made in order to conceal and hide this particular box. God's presence was revealed at that particular box. So those are unique features we ought to keep in mind with it. Think of everything working toward that ark and having some relationship to it in some way, even its physical presence or the act that's done in connection with it. Second, after unique features, it had a unique significance that is connected with the Ark of the Covenant. And the basic significance of it is this. Fellowship with God is here and no place else. For that, look at Exodus 25 and verse 22. In these preceding verses, he's describing the way the ark is made, the lid that is put on it, the cherubim that are on each side of it. And God says in verse 22, "And there." And the "there" is pointing to the Ark of the Covenant, between and on the lid. "There I will meet with you." So the significance is important. This is where God is met. This is why we said this morning, nobody that knows the tabernacle is a bit uncomfortable or surprised with Christ's words, "I am the way, the truth, and the life, and nobody gets to the Father except by me." They understood that one-way thing, and they understood it very, very well, because God had taught it through the tabernacle. Now, we need to get in order six things that relate to the physical makeup of the ark. And we'll list the things that are part of its physical makeup, and then we'll move to what do these things mean. The first place is you have the box itself. And the box itself is described in 25:10 through 15. And we'll simply read those verses. Verse 10. Now, there is an interesting thing, by the way. While we have a model of the tabernacle here, one of the great problems is knowing how exactly to make it. No question about the Holy of Holies and the holy place. No question about the position of the brazen altar, the laver, where the ark was. That's all clear. But in some of the minor details, and I think you that worked on it probably found this, is you find some real problems with how does this thing put together? And you have a little bit of a problem with it. And I think that is probably significant. The tabernacle can never be perfectly reproduced again. We know a lot about it, but it can never be completely reproduced again. What do you think God had in mind when he made the tabernacle in such a way that could never be physically reproduced again? Very, very simple reason. It's a picture. And Christ has already tabernacled among us, and God is simply saying, "I don't want you to be able to reconstruct it perfectly again. I'll leave you some of the details and some of the general picture of it, but I don't want you to reconstruct it again, because we don't want to have the first church of the holy tabernacle resurrected again." So it's like God saying, "I'll let you see the blueprint, but I'm going to obscure part of the measurements on that, because I don't want any more tabernacles around, because this was only the picture. With the arrival of Christ, the real person is here." So, the box itself, verse 10, "They shall construct an ark." Ark, box. It's a rectangular box of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits long. There are two ways to go on a cubit. The most likely cubit is 18 inches. And I didn't figure this in my head. 2 cubits would be 18, 36, 3 feet then. And 3 feet plus 3 feet plus, thank you, 3 feet, 9 inches, and 1.5 cubits wide, 1.5 cubits wide, which 2 feet, 3 inches, and 1.5 cubits high, which would be same. Okay. So you're thinking of a rectangular box. Well, let's just use the outer court. That's probably fairly close. Okay. And verse 11. "You shall overlay it with pure gold. Inside and out you shall overlay it, and you shall make a gold molding around it. And you shall cast 4 rings for it, and fasten them on its 4 feet. And 2 rings shall be on one side of it, and 2 rings on the other. You shall make poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. And you shall put the poles into the rings on the sides of the ark to carry the ark with them. The poles shall remain in the rings of the ark. They shall not be removed from it." And so there then is the box itself, very beautiful thing, gold overlaid. Second important thing is the contents of the box. We'll talk about what this means later, but let's just get the picture in mind. What is in the box, the contents of the box? Now that's given here, but we learn more about it in the book of Hebrews. Notice in this part, in verse 16, of chapter 25, you change to the contents of it. It says, "You shall put into the ark the testimony which I shall give you." Now keep your finger here, because we'll be right back to it, but go to Hebrews 9:4. And this passage tells us more about the things that were in the ark. Chapter 9, verse 4. Well, let's go back to verse 2. There was a tabernacle prepared, the outer one, in which the lampstand and the table and the sacred bread, which is called the holy place. And behind the second veil, that's the one in front of the Holy of Holies, behind the second veil, there was a tabernacle which is called the Holy of Holies, having a golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which was the golden jar holding the manna, Aaron's rod which budded, and the tables of the covenant. So the contents of the box then are three things. Pot of manna, and this will all be significant, Aaron's rod, and a copy of the law. So think of all of that put inside of the box. Okay, back to Exodus. We're just building up the physical part now. All right, the third thing that is important and needs to be separated out is the lid. 25, verse 17. You shall make a mercy seat. Unfortunately for us, seat means something that you sit on. That's not true. Nobody sat on this seat at all. It was not a seat for sitting. It was a lid. And basically, that's exactly what it is. You shall make a mercy seat or a lid of pure gold, 2.5 cubits long and 1.5 cubits wide, so it would fit right on top of the box. Then, following the lid, on each end of the box, you had the cherubim. So think of your box, put a lid on it, put the cherubim down at the end. Fifth, on the lid, you had blood. We'll not go to it, but Leviticus chapter 16 and verse 14 talks about how one day out of the year, on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, how the priest would come inside the veil and he would put blood there. So there was blood on top of the lid. All right? Next, or finally, sixth, there was the veil to isolate, so nobody could see into the Holy of Holies. It was isolated, blocked off. Now, with those six things in mind, let's look at the lessons that those things teach, or were intended to teach. The first thing it taught was the basis of fellowship with God. Or the terms of fellowship, if you like that better. The basis or terms of fellowship with God. Fellowship with God was based on the blood, which of course represented death. All of the sin of Israel was literally, if you could look at it, it was literally under blood. Because the law and the manna and so forth, and we'll see what they represent in just a moment, but they were all literally underneath a lid that had blood on top of it, showing the fellowship. The basis of fellowship with God is through death and based on this. All right. Second, the contents of the box. The contents of the box represent Israel's sin. Now, in what way? First of all, you had the law. What did Israel do with God's law? Broke it every way you could possibly break it. And consequently, the law represented God's authority, and the law in there, the way Israel treated it, represents their rebellion against God's authority. God's authority was stated in the law. His will was stated there. What he desired was stated there, and what he commanded of Israel was stated there, and they broke it all. They literally shattered God's law. They rejected, they rebelled against his authority. And the symbol of their rejection of God's authority is in the box under the lid. Second, you had the manna. The pot of manna, the way the people eventually treated that is Numbers chapter 11. Numbers 11. Numbers 11, verse 4. It says, the rabble who were among them had greedy desires. And the sons of Israel wept again and said, "Who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we used to eat free in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, and the onions, and the garlic." And doesn't that sound great? We're having for dinner today leeks, onions, and garlic. They must have left a great odor in the wilderness, did they not? Never forget being in Paris and the subways, they eat garlic. And you hit the subway, it's just like hitting a wall of garlic breath. Verse 6, "But now our appetite is gone. There is nothing to look at except this manna." The manna represented their rejection of God's provision. And the interesting thing is that their sin in rejecting God's provision is put in a vase, in the box, where? Under the lid. There was nothing worse than the ark with the lid off. Because when you see the ark with the lid off, then God looks right down and He sees the law that Israel broke. He sees the manna that He provided for them that they rejected. And you take the lid off and God sees sin and God's wrath is thus roused. Put the lid back on and God does not see the sin. He does not see the rebellion. He does not see the rejection of provision because the lid is there. And that lid will carry one of the greatest doctrines in the New Testament. We'll take a look tonight at a key passage, key doctrinal passage in the New Testament, the book of Romans, that talks about how this lid ultimately pictured the doctrine of propitiation. Third thing in the box was Aaron's rod that budded. Remember the occasion there. We'll get to it when we come to the book of Numbers, which we'll be doing soon. But the rod came about and it budded because there was a great rebellion against God's leaders. And consequently, the rod of Aaron that budded would always remind them that you had rejected God's leadership and refused it. And so the rod pointed back to and reminded them of the incident of the refusal of God's leadership. And those are all sinful things, obviously. The symbol of the rejection of the leadership of God is found where? In the box and under the lid. So that when God appeared, He looked down and He saw the lid. He did not see the sin. And this is a great object lesson that is being taught in preparation for New Testament doctrine, New Testament truth. Okay, if this illustrates the basis of fellowship with God, then how can this ark, how can this illustration preserve the fact that this box and the blood on the box can only illustrate salvation? It can't provide it. And what do we have here that shows that it can only illustrate? What did God put there to show that it really can't get you access to God? It is really not possible. What did God do? Well, after He gave them something that symbolized the basis of their fellowship with God, He then pulled the curtain shut. And the curtain reminds them of the fact that this is an illustration. This can't really bring you to God. It can only illustrate the truth. And that is going to be there because, obviously, the only adequate approach to God is going to be through the perfect, sinless sacrifice of the Son Himself. And God visually preserved that reminder that the approach to God is not complete by putting up a no trespassing sign, and essentially that's what the veil is. All right? That is all we're going to say now about the ark. Now let's look at the lid that went on the ark. And let's go to the passage that ties so much doctrine into this lid, Romans 3. Romans 3. And before we get to it, and you'll see, I think it's better if I tell you before. See verse 25, we're going to look at verses 24 and 25. But notice in verse 25 it says, whom, speaking of Christ, God displayed publicly as a propitiation. And there is the word which the Septuagint uses to translate the word mercy seat. And so he was set forth publicly as the mercy seat. In other words, there's a tie-in between what Christ did on the cross, or the doctrine of propitiation, and the lid that goes on the ark. And I think we'll be able to see how that is vividly illustrated. All right, first of all, notice God talks about the subject of these verses is God's saving work. And the first thing we get is something about the nature of his work, expressed in the opening words of verse 24, being justified. Now let's do a little work with that word, being justified. Good time to spend some time with that, because we have not really been into doctrinal lessons for some time, whereby we look at a doctrine. But let's look at justification for just a moment. And first of all, say what it is not. Sometimes you can, through a process of elimination, by showing what a thing isn't, you can come to begin to see what it is. First of all, it is not forgiveness. There's forgiveness and justification, but it is not forgiveness. The reason that, by way of illustration, is a little boy throws a rock through a window. He comes and apologizes, and he's get forgiven, but what about the guilt? He is still guilty of it. And so to say that justification means I'm forgiven is like trying to put a pop bottle lid on a quart jar. It's a lid, and it will cover part of the jar, but it's not big enough to cover it. And forgiveness is not big enough, because justification deals with the guilt of sin also. So it is not forgiveness. Second, it's not a pardon. Can you think of why justification is not a pardon? A pardon looks at past acts, and justification is bigger than that. Justification is not dealing with past acts. When we're justified, our sin, past, present, and future, is dealt with. So pardon is too little, because pardons look back. Justification is bigger than that. It is not being innocent. It's not being like Adam. All right? Then what is it? And this may be a little bit of a long-handled definition, but it is this. It is God declaring the sinner righteous. God declaring the sinner righteous. Now that's the basic part of it. Notice I did not say it is God making the sinner righteous. God making the sinner, what's the word for God making the sinner righteous? It's called sanctification. It's the Christian life. That's God making us. Justification is not making the sinner righteous. It is declaring the sinner righteous. Now you say, well, how can God do that? Well, it is God declaring the sinner righteous on the basis of two things. On the basis of the historical death of Christ. But there's got to be more than that. Christ has died historically for sinners, but that doesn't make every sinner justified. If we stop the definition right here, this would teach that everybody is justified, because everybody qualifies to being sinners, and if justification is God declaring the sinner righteous on the basis of the historical death of Christ, then everyone would be declared righteous. And there's more to it than that, because it's based on the historical death of Christ and experiential union with him, conditioned on faith. I know that's a little bit long, but I want to get a good thorough definition. We ought to know thoroughly what our justification is. Okay, first word, God, that's the source. He's the only one that can do it. It's a declaration. It's not making us into something. And it is directed toward sinners. That's how we qualify for justification. And it is positive, righteous, not just saying, I forgive you, not just saying, I turn my back on things, but I give you something. And that is called righteousness. And he does it based on the historical death of Christ. Now, let me give a little definition of what I mean by historical death and experiential union. By historical, I simply mean this happened apart from anything we did. Apart from contributing sin, we had nothing historically to do with the death of Christ. We weren't there. We weren't born yet. And that's what we mean by historical death. This happened apart from any action on man's part. Experiential means this happens only when we do something to bring it about. And what is it that we do experientially to bring about union with Christ? Faith. So when we come by faith and rest on the historical death of Christ that was accomplished without our assistance, we come and are placed into experiential union with Christ, and that is conditioned on our faith in Him. That is what justification is. All right? Now, what do you think would move God? What would motivate Him to do a thing like that? What would move God to do that? What would motivate Him? Well, that's given in Romans 3. Being justified as a gift. As a gift is a translation of one single Greek word, dorean, D-O-R-E-A-N. Dorean occurs 9 times in the New Testament, and basically our word gratis would get it. It's the idea of there is no cause in the person to whom it's being given. It's given freely. The best example of dorean I know is in John 15:25. Very vivid one, in Christ's own words. John 15 and verse 25. And the reason this is such a good illustration, as you well know, all of the suffering of Christ was undeserved. He didn't deserve any of it. And so in verse 25 he says, "They have done this in order that the word may be fulfilled that is written in their law, they hated me, dorean. They hated me without cause." And that simply means I was hated, but there was nothing whatsoever in me that deserved it. Now take that back then to Romans 3. This takes a little thinking and discipline to get, because if someone gives you a present and you try to think of their motivation, where do you go first of all to find it out? You go to the natural place we all go to, me. They like me. I must be nice. And we look for the motivation that we surely did something of a gracious thing that moved them and motivated them to give something to us. And Paul is teaching in Romans, when we have justification, God couldn't find anything in you that caused it to be deserved. Now, when God gives something gratuitously without any merit on the part of the one that gets it, what's the word for that? Grace. And isn't that what we have in Romans 3? Being justified without any cause in the sinner. And here's the name of what that is. And so let's put that down as, after the definition, after the motivation, the definition of His work. And it is by His grace. The definition of a dorean salvation is called grace. Like what someone said a while back, saying that someone made the comment that we don't deserve God's blessings. And the other person's remark I thought was excellent. He said, that doesn't say half of it. We don't even deserve His attention, much less His salvation. And this is the kind of salvation Paul is teaching in this context. Now, let's get down to the how can God do all this justifying? What's the basis? And the basis is twofold. We'll only look at one, reading the rest of the verse, or all of 24, being justified as a gift by His grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God displayed publicly as a propitiation. And so notice, it's the person and the work of Christ, his work in particular in redemption, and his work in particular in propitiation. Now that's the word that we want to work with in closing out tonight, the word propitiation. Several things about it. Number one, the word propitiation simply means place of satisfaction. And as we said, that is the word that the Septuagint used to translate mercy seat in the Old Testament. So that when we go back to the lid on the box, what was the lid? The lid was the place where God was satisfied. And I will, at the risk of laughter, go ahead and do some artwork. Here is the box, and the three objects representing Israel's sin are in the box. There is blood on the lid. This is place of satisfaction. And then on each side, you'd have the cherubim. Cherubim are always associated with protecting God's judgments or God's righteousness. When God dismisses Adam and Eve from the garden, he puts at the garden to guard the gate and to uphold his judgment, puts the cherubim, and they're always in association with that. Then, of course, up here is the presence of God himself. So what is the picture? The picture is God looks down, and when he looks down, he sees the lid with the blood, and he has fellowship. Take the lid off, and you've got a horrible picture, because you take the lid off. Notice that there is the cherubim associated with the wrath of God, and why doesn't the wrath of God fall on the people? Real simple. There are sins in the box. And we ought to be able to identify easily, why doesn't God's wrath fall on us? Why can we be confident that we have a standing with him? For a simple reason. My sin and your sin is in the box. What's the box? The box is the cross. And of course, the book of Romans is talking about how Christ, now a person, is this. He's the lid on the box. And therefore, when God looks at me, I am in reality a sinner. But when God looks down, his cherubim cannot take wrath on me for a very simple reason. My sin is in the box. And when he looks down, he sees the propitiatory work of Jesus Christ, and he is satisfied. One of the greatest difficulties in getting the gospel across is to get people as satisfied with the cross as God is. And any time we have doubts about our salvation, always come back to the lid on the box and simply say to yourself, self, why don't you get as satisfied with Jesus Christ and his work on the cross as God is? And when we do that, we recognize that moping around and saying, oh, I'm not worthy of salvation, is nothing noble. In fact, that's almost a slap in the face of the work of Christ, because that's looking at ourselves rather than looking at the lid on the box or the person and the work of Christ as far as salvation is concerned. So take the lid off and you have a horrible thing. Put the lid on and the blood comes between the two. And so you can see how a heavy, heavy doctrine is coming across through this particular thing. All right, I want to keep each one of these things as a unit, and so I'll just put down the next thing we'll be doing, which will be Wednesday evening. We'll want to look at the veil. And we will start right there. Father, we're thankful tonight for the lessons of the tabernacle. We pray that we will learn them well. We are so grateful that you pictured in the Old Testament so we could see it. The way you can have fellowship with us, we're thankful that you want fellowship. It's an amazing thing. But you would come down to these people and say, I want your contributions, but I want them willingly. I want to have fellowship with you. I want to dwell with you. And then proceed in vivid imagery that they could see to give a box, put their sin in the box, put a lid on the box, cover it with blood, and appear on top of that box, look down, and your wrath was not on your people, because there was propitiation. And we're thankful for that great New Testament doctrine that Jesus Christ is a propitiation for our sins once and for all and forever. And we stand tonight justified in your presence on that basis. We give you thanks for it in his name.